Logan, if I knew that, I wouldn't be telling
you'd
you.
Be rich. You'd be rich by now.
One of the things that AI starts to show us, I think, is that in a lot of respects, often, the product itself doesn't really matter that much. I'm really interested in primarily in what these models tell us about ourselves and about how we actually engage in and think about the production of texts. And I think in a lot of respects, the real problem is that a lot of people really like producing bullshit because they like consuming bullshit.
All right, welcome back to the Middle Tech Podcast. You've got Logan Jones here with Evan Knowles, and today we are joined by a previous guest of ours. We last had him on back in March of 2022 for episode 185. Today we are joined by Professor Brian Fry, who is a UK law professor at University of Kentucky's College of Law. So last time we had him on, we talked about copyright law and NFTs, which was kind of the craze at the time in 2022. This time, we're going to be talking about copyright law and artificial intelligence. So we're excited to get into this conversation. There's a lot going on in this space right now. And before we dive into this conversation, we just want to get a quick word from our sponsors. Before highlighting our sponsors, we'd just like to state that the views and content shared on this platform do not necessarily reflect those of our show sponsors. Middle Tech is presented by KY Innovation, the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development's Office of Entrepreneurship. KY Innovation exists to support and develop Kentucky's startup ecosystem, and we are proud to be supported by an organization whose mission aligns so closely with ours. If you're a founder building in Kentucky, you need to check out the resources that KY Innovation has to offer. You can find more information by clicking the link in our show notes or going to kyinnovation.com.
Middle Tech is sponsored by Bolt Marketing. Take your website to the next level with a website that's built to work. At Bolt Marketing, they're revolutionizing websites for small businesses that are affordable, customizable, and hassle-free. Whether you have a construction company, a boutique clothing store, or you own a hot yoga studio, they have options for you. Click the link in our show notes to explore their marketing options that can transform your marketing and grow your business. And as a personal note, Bolt Marketing built our website, and they were awesome to work with throughout the entire process. We highly recommend working with them.
Middle Tech is also sponsored by GoTenna, the world's leading mobile mesh networking provider that's revolutionizing how first responders and defense teams stay connected during critical missions in austere or comms-denied environments. They partner with Kentucky's defense tech innovators, ensuring secure and reliable off-grid connections. If you're a founder looking to enhance your technology's communication capabilities for off-grid operations, GoTenna is looking to collaborate. Check them out at go.gotenna.com/middletech or reach out to us to get connected. All right, Brian, welcome back on to the Middle Tech Podcast. We're excited to have you back on. Last time we had you on, like I was saying in the intro there, NFTs and crypto were kind of the craze. Now it is artificial intelligence. And been following you on Twitter. You've got some good thoughts that you put out about this stuff. So we're excited to have you back on to talk about all of this.
I'm delighted to be here. And it's interesting how quickly the tech cycles move these
It does.
Days.
It does, absolutely. Well, just to kind of kick us off here, what we want to spend some time covering, well, actually, before we get into the stories, let's spend a little bit of time covering your background, because that was pretty relevant for the last episode that we did. You had a stint in film art before you actually got into law, which was relevant to copyright and things like that. So just kind of give us your background at a high level as it's relevant to copyright law and, you know, how you got into the field that you're in currently.
Sure. Yeah. So as you say, before going to law school, I was a film student as an undergraduate. And then I did a graduate degree, an MFA at the San Francisco Art Institute in film, kind of conceptual art, new media, that kind of stuff, and worked as an artist, an arts journalist, and a kind of programmer for many years, about 5 years in New York before going to law school, which has influenced my subsequent career. I did go to NYU for law school, worked for a couple judges, and then worked on Wall Street at Sullivan & Cromwell, a big white shoe law firm, for several years before transitioning into academia. So I'm kind of one of those like unusual lawyer, artist, banking, finance kind of background people, which isn't a typical sort of skill set, but I think it served me well in especially thinking about new developments in technology, specifically in the intersection of technology and law, specifically intellectual property law, and even more specifically, copyright law and related bodies of law.
Yeah, sounds like the perfect concoction of experience. Talk about what you're doing specifically at UK and your role there and what you're teaching students at UK.
Sure. So I primarily teach intellectual property related classes. So I teach like a survey class on intellectual property writ large, covering, you know, patent law, copyright law, trademark law, as well as trade secrets and right of publicity and design patents, kind of a smorgasbord of different IP doctrines. I also tend to teach a class focused on copyright law exclusively. And on occasion, I teach trademark classes as well. I also teach a seminar class, kind of thinking about intellectual property theory and helping students develop their own kind of scholarly projects. And then I teach a range of just kind of bread and butter classes. I've taught civil procedure, professional responsibility, contracts, property, constitutional law, you name it, a little bit of everything. I try to be a jack of all trades, as it were.
Yeah, and that really, in a lot of ways, suits you perfectly to be able to understand all the different dynamics at play with something like a new technology being developed, such as artificial intelligence. And so, you know, the catalyst for reaching back out to have you on the podcast was a lot of these lawsuits that we see coming out right now. So a few that we wanted to talk about today are between the New York Times and OpenAI. There's one between Getty Images and Stability AI. And then I think actually just either yesterday or this week, a new one has come out with NVIDIA, which I'm not sure if you've seen that one yet, but it's definitely starting to pick up the pace in terms of, you know, these lawsuits coming out and how these companies are going to have to start thinking about training their models as it relates to copyright law. So if we could just start off by, you know, we were discussing before we got on the call, Evan and I are not the most knowledgeable in the legal field. So if you can just start off by kind of talking about the different bases for these cases that are being brought against these companies, I think that would be a good jumping off point.
Sure. So I mean, I think an important place to start is to recognize that the technology in some respects is actually not that new, but some applications of it are really new, or at least different in ways that feel really new. But when we talk about AI, really what we're fundamentally talking about is variations on what's otherwise known as like machine learning. And that technology has actually been around for a long time, right? So I mean, like the Facebook algorithm, right, that decides what to show you, or Spotify telling you, you know, what song is going to come up next, YouTube figuring out which video you might want to watch. Those are applications of AI technology as well. I think what's really new is the introduction of ChatGPT, general purpose transformers, and these large language models, as well as sort of their relatives in the image and video data processing worlds. And I think what's really kind of new about them is fundamentally that they change our perception of what machines are capable of doing, right? So prior to ChatGPT, right, I think there was a general assumption that, you know, you could have text generation programs that would spit out text, but it wasn't they weren't all that effective, right? I mean, the text that they produced was kind of clunky and sort of falling into that uncanny valley of literature, as it were, where you could tell it was produced by a machine. And, you know, I actually used some early versions several years ago of text generation software to produce different texts for various purposes. And it was, you know, they were interesting and fun to play with, but they produced material that wasn't very convincingly human-like, as it were. And I think the big development, as everyone who's used them, which has got to be most people by now, with ChatGPT and the other similar LLM programs out there that have been released, is that they are capable of really quickly producing significant quantities of text that read convincingly like something produced by a person. If anything, they produce text that's better written than a lot of people produce, frankly, which is a little bit, it's interesting and a little bit arguably disturbing on, depending on where you're coming from. And the image generation softwares do much the same thing, right? Similar kinds of software has been around for quite some time now, but the newer iterations of it likewise produce images of startling complexity and quality, as it were. Although I think the image generating and video generating software has farther to go in terms of being fully convincing than text generation does. And I suspect that has a lot to do with the fact that the text generating programs are working with kind of a different unit, as it were, right? Like words are the unit of a text generation software, pixels are the unit generation of the image and video generating software. And I think, you know, the fact that you're working with a different kind of substrate means that what actually gets produced ends up being, you know, of differing levels of complexity and convincingness as well. So there you have it, really. I mean, at the end of the day, I think what's really new is the fact that these new systems, these AI programs, show us that a lot of what we thought was unique to people and could only be accomplished by people is actually automatable in ways that were only imaginable in science fiction really not that long ago.
Yeah, and I think it helps to kind of set the groundwork for what's actually kind of going on behind the scenes with these models, which is, for instance, let's take OpenAI. They have taken just a large, insanely large corpus of text from the internet and really pushed it through this new architecture, which at its foundational level is new because of transformers and using GPUs and really this neural net architecture of large language models to predict the next token or the next word using all of the internet's open text. And in this particular first case, maybe you can simplify what I just said in relation to how the New York Times is viewing that. Mm-hmm. They're taking New York Times articles, incorporating it into that foundational pre-training in the foundation model. And so when somebody goes and says, hey, what happened with this so-and-so story, it's spitting out in New York Times's claim, word for word, what might have been an article from them in the past, which could make sense because it's predicting the next word. And if there's an article that perfectly fits the prompt that New York Times wrote, it'll probably spit out that something close to it. So take what I just kind of laid out there as far as maybe just a really easy to understand way of how these models work and maybe simplify it even further if you can, but relate it to what New York Times is claiming.
Sure. So I think a big part of the problem here is that copyright doctrine really isn't designed to deal with this new technology. And that's nothing new, right? New technologies have come along at many points in time over the years. And copyright doctrine, copyright law, tends to develop in a kind of punctuated equilibrium, as it were, right? The law changes as new technologies change the landscape of the market that copyright law is regulating. But in order to understand why it's such a problem for copyright law, I think it's helpful to understand, at least at a kind of high level, how these AI systems, at least putatively, work. And I think we're going to learn a lot about how they actually are constructed and how they actually work in the course of the litigation, right? Currently, we've got a lot of kind of high-level explanation, but there's, I think, still a lot of the nuts and bolts of the internal workings of the systems are a little bit unclear. But broadly speaking, right, the idea is you take the AI system and train it on a really large corpus of texts, images, content of one kind or another. And at least in theory, what these programs do is not make and retain copies of whatever they're being trained on, but rather analyze whatever they're being trained on and break it down into its constituent elements, right? And in fact, they kind of turn text or turn images or turn videos into kind of instructions or elements, as it were, rather than the original content of the material. And that's what ends up getting stored. And then when you type a prompt into the LLM or into the image or video generating software, it uses that prompt, right, to decide, or kind of to predict, as it were, what would normally happen, what would be the most likely thing to be produced in response to the prompt in question. At least that's how they're typically described, right? It's hard to know exactly what's behind the hood in some respect. And I think that that's going to be important for the litigation, because I think the courts and the lawyers and the courts kind of wrestling with these lawsuits are going to have to figure out exactly what's happening in order to understand to the best of their ability how to kind of map the law onto the technology, right? So there's a number of points along that process that I just described at which copyright law might become salient or relevant, right? So the initial point is, and the key thing to understand about copyright law, right, especially when it comes to digital technology and digital works, right, is it's primarily concerned with reproduction of copyrighted works of one kind or another. So that could be literary works, like any kind of text is a literary work. It could be pictorial works, that'd be any kind of image. It could be motion pictures, that would be any kind of a video. So the initial question, and I think ultimately the one that is going to be the hardest for, in some respects anyway, for the AI companies to wrestle with, is the question of whether or not a reproduction of these works was necessary in order to do the training in the first instance, right? So as you recall, right, I said the way you develop an AI model is to train the algorithms on a really, really huge corpus of material, right? Well, the question then is, in order to train the model, do you have to make copies of whatever you're training it on, right? And if the answer to that is yes, well, then you've got a per se reproduction of the works in question. That's a prima facie copyright infringement, right? Creating copies of digital files is copyright infringing. So to the extent that that was necessary, or to the extent that that actually has already happened, right, the AI companies are going to have to defend themselves not on a non-infringement theory, but on a fair use theory, right? The idea being that, yes, we did the copying, but the copying should be non-infringing because we were using it for a different purpose, right? There's some justification for it, right? It shouldn't be found to be infringing because it was necessary in order to produce a result that didn't compete with the owners of the copyrights in the original works, you name it, right? And at least at the moment, that initial copying claim is the one that is seems to be the most viable in all of these lawsuits that have been filed, right? Because there's a whole bunch of different lawsuits, but they're all kind of variations on the same theme. So the first claim that they're making, and the claim that so far has tended to stick around, that survived motions to dismiss, right? That the courts are sort of looking at as being the kind of core claim being made, is this one about the initial copying. So copying in the context of training. Okay, then there's a second question, right? And I'm simplifying to some degree. There's lots of intermediate questions, but these are sort of the big picture ones. The second question is, what's actually in the model, right? So the AI companies say the model is just these kind of abstract rules, right? It doesn't include any actual images or texts or videos or anything along those lines. It's just these abstract vector rule things that tell the system how to predict what to do in response to a prompt. I guess I take them at their word for that, right? I don't know. I mean, that's what they say. That's how they say it works. And wow, I guess we'll find out whether or not that's an actually accurate description of what's in the model, or whether it's not an accurate description of what's in the model. But until you actually kind of get people who know coming in and kind of stipulating to various facts, who knows? But if they're taking texts, images, or videos and actually reproducing copies, digital copies of them inside the model itself, well, that would be infringing as well, right? And if that's true, I think that would be a more troubling form of infringement, because it would mean ongoing usage of the copyrighted works in order for the AI model to actually function, right? So if that's the case, if there's copies embedded in the model rather than just copies made for the purpose of training, I think that's going to be a tougher hurdle for the AI companies to get over. It would still be a fair use defense, right? But it would be a harder one. The third question then is, what about the output, right? So when you type in a prompt, the AI is going to spit out a text or an image or a video, and that text, image, or video might be really similar to something that already exists. And so then the question becomes, is whatever the AI model is spitting out is really similar to a copyrighted work that belongs to someone? Is whatever is getting spit out infringing, right? And if so, when is it infringing? And who is the infringer, right? So we've got kind of three different points where the analysis needs to take place. In general, to the extent courts have kind of thought about these cases and actually had any rulings on them so far, the second two they've tended to boot, right? And specifically, there was one filed by Sarah Silverman and some other writers and authors and whatnot against Facebook and some of the other AI companies. And the court booted a bunch of their claims on the ground that they just hadn't pled enough facts to actually substantiate the arguments that they were making. Now, the New York Times, as you say, in their lawsuit, they at least purported to include several almost entire stories from the New York Times that the AI software produced in response to prompts, allegedly, right? So they managed to survive on that third theory, right? The idea that the AI was producing or handing over, like essentially in response to prompts, producing copyright infringing texts that were substantially similar or identical to existing copyrighted works of authorship, right? So their claim is stronger on that last prong than a lot of other claims have been, because, you know, substantial similarity has to be really quite close indeed. So a lot of the companies have tried to plead substantial similarity of generated works using works that kind of looks in the ballpark of, but not actually all that much like the works that they own. And so I think those kind of claims aren't particularly compelling. The New York Times claim on its face looks really good. However, there was a response to the New York Times's complaint, right? It's a motion to dismiss, essentially. And in the motion, the sort of counter argument, which is not entirely a legal argument, but kind of a legal argument, was that in effect, the New York Times could only get the AI system to produce super duper similar works by engaging in a kind of like prompt hacking, right? In other words, it didn't do it all by itself. They had to feed a lot of information into it and craft the prompt really carefully over a long period of time in order to induce, as it were, the model to produce the infringing work that they wanted it to produce. So that's a problem for the Times on two levels, right? The first, I think, because if that's true, it means that it's less likely that we would look at these AI systems as being infringing, because, you know, any technology can produce infringing works if you use it with the intent to be infringing, right? I mean, you know, Microsoft Word can produce infringing texts if you type them in, right? I mean, you know, a camera can produce an infringing work if you take a photograph of something that's protected by copyright. That doesn't make the technology infringing. It means that you, the user, are intentionally engaging in infringing activity. I think the second problem that the New York Times and its lawyers may face, and we'll see where this goes, right, is if they engaged in prompt hacking in order to produce the examples that they produced, and they didn't tell the court, or even worse, if they led the court to believe that they hadn't engaged in any kind of prompt hacking, that could be a real problem for them. Not because of their legal theory, but because the one thing courts dislike more than anything else is litigants who don't tell the truth, right? So I'm very interested to see kind of how this develops, because if it turns out to be the case that the New York Times was not forthcoming in its explanation of what it did in order to produce these very similar texts, I think the court will not be happy about that.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things that I think is baffling everybody, including the companies developing this technology, is there's a narrative out there that even OpenAI and Anthropic and Google don't actually know why these systems produce the answers and outputs that they do. Mm-hmm. And the good perfect example of that, if somebody want to go test it right now with a friend, if somebody typed in a prompt to ChatGPT and then the next person came along and typed in the same prompt, the output will likely be different. And so there's this really one disturbing narrative out there that even the companies producing this technology don't know how it works yet. Because it's all, you know, very, very complex algorithms that are predictive algorithms. And that's highly, can be highly volatile depending on the use case. And what are the courts going to look at and say relative to that when OpenAI, and this also kind of tracks back to the argument right now with proprietary versus open source models, is for safety reasons, it's also important for everybody to know what's going on behind the hood and to open that up. So what are the courts, you think, going to say to that narrative of, is OpenAI going to be able to come forward and say in a very detailed manner, here's why this output was given? And if they can't do that, then what do you think the court's going to say?
Yeah, so two separate thoughts on that front. And first of all, is it okay if I use a curse word?
Sure. Yeah.
Let it rip.
Okay, because I actually think in this context, it's a technical term, but it's also used as a curse word. But I actually think it's really helpful in kind of framing how I think we should think about AI systems. So I think that a lot of people have the misunderstanding or misapprehension that these AI systems are engaging in some kind of thinking activity when they produce a text, or when they produce an image, when they produce a video, because it is a convincing simulacrum of being spoken to by a person or a person producing meaning bearing content. But that's totally wrong, right? If these systems work the way the people who made them said that they work, broadly speaking, and I believe that that is true, what they actually are is bullshit generators. Right. And that's all they are. And that sounds like a denigration, but I don't intend it as a denigration at all. In fact, I think it's absolutely astonishing on a number of levels, and underscores exactly why I think AI will ultimately be such a valuable technology in this field, as well as in a whole bunch of other areas, which are totally unrelated, right? And again, AI describes an entire body of different ways that computers can go about doing things. And we're here just talking about one subset of applications for AI, namely generating content of one kind or another. And I think one thing we really forget is the extent to which we produce and consume vast quantities of bullshit information, right? I mean, think about all of those emails and texts and social media posts clogging up your feed all the time, right? Somebody had to produce those, right? Even if you're not reading them, and even if you don't care about them, somebody was involved in doing all the work of getting them out there, right? And businesses, right, consist of huge numbers of people creating enormous quantities of bullshit information of one kind or another, right? I think one of the many things that these AI systems will do is automate out a lot of that bullshit generation. Maybe convince us that a lot of it was never worth doing in the first place, but at the very least, make it a lot faster and more efficient to produce. So that's a huge benefit. I think it's also really scary for a lot of people, right? Specifically, it's scary for people in white collar jobs and in professions. Blue collar workers have dealt with automation for a long time, right? I mean, blue collar workers have had to reckon with automation since the Industrial Revolution. White collar workers never have in the same kind of fundamental way. And I think for a long time, we assumed that that was never going to be an issue. And I think AI has shown us that many of the things that white collar workers and professionals do are actually automatable in part or in whole. And I think that's really scary for a lot of people. So I think in a lot of respects, what we're seeing is also the rise of a kind of white collar Luddism, as it were, in relation to AI technology, right? Because people are seeing a program that can automate a skill set that they have invested a large amount of time and energy in developing. And I think that's a problem for people in writing professions, but it's also a problem, especially for people in kind of art generation type professions, right? Where, you know, it takes a lot of time and energy to develop the skills to produce images that people find pleasing in a generic sort of way. And then it turns out that an AI system can do it automatically, right? I think what that shows us, which we also find very uncomfortable, I think, in a lot of ways, is that a lot of what we do is bullshitting. Yeah. For better or for worse, right? And the AI just shows us how much bullshit we produce. And in what I hope that has as a consequence is convince us to think a little bit differently about how we think about ownership and how we think about authorship, right? So at this moment in time, right, we think very expansively about copyright ownership of any kind of work that's generated. And we use the word creativity to talk about what it means to create works of various kinds. I think that's a huge misnomer, right? The overwhelming majority of what people produce is generic, bland, and not particularly interesting or intrinsically valuable, but we give people ownership anyway because it enables a kind of easier way of facilitating transactions around different kinds of, you know, business dealings that we want to engage in. I hope that AI shows us that many of the things that we currently treat as valuable and protectable are actually not particularly special or unique, and maybe not deserving of property-like protection in the first place, right? And maybe it'll encourage us in the long term to think differently about copyright ownership writ large. I think in the short term, that's not gonna happen, right? That's gonna be a paradigm shift that's gonna take a long time. However, I think in the short term, what's likely to happen is courts are going to wrestle with the tension between what copyright doctrine says that they should do and what people want out of a technology. So I would make one big picture observation. As I said earlier, right, copyright is always affected by technology, right? So new technologies that affect meaning creation industries, right, are always changing in various ways how we think about copyright ownership. And so, like, one great example for me would be the introduction of the VCR, right? So when the VCR was introduced, the movie and television studios lost their mind, right? Because they were sure that this was the end of their business model, right? They were in the business of showing people movies at theaters or on TV, whenever, you know, on broadcast on a schedule. And the assumption was the introduction of the VCR as new technology was going to enable people not to have to go to the theater anymore and to watch things at home and not have to consume advertising, right? And so they campaigned really vigorously against VCRs because they were concerned that this was like the end of their business. It turned out it was actually a huge boon to their business, right? Nothing was better for the movie studios than the VCR and better for the television companies than the VCR because it just showed them that people wanted to consume way more content than was actually available to them prior to the introduction of the VCR. We saw a replay of that with streaming services. Right. Once again, they were all convinced this was the end of their business. They were never going to be able to survive streaming. They were just going to go out of business because there would be no way for them to make money. They're in the business of selling copies to people. And it turned out actually it was the best thing that, once again, the best thing that ever happened to them. Right. Because it meant that their costs went down, their profits went up. That's the best, you know, that's a business person's dream. Right. That's what you want to see happen. Right. In both cases, however, the industry really resisted because they don't like these kind of technology driven paradigm shifts, right? They're not used to change in that kind of fundamental way. I suspect we're going to see something really similar with AI, right? Because there's always areas for profit out there, and businesses are going to figure out how to profit. The observation I would make about that in relation to courts is that my gut tells me, right, that the way courts think about copyright and new technology is that they look at the technology and ask themselves, is this technology that consumers want in order to accomplish something valuable? Or is this technology designed only in order to get around copyright law? Right? So if it's the former, if it's a VCR, if it's streaming, right? If it's other, it's something like Google Books or Google Image Search, right? All these things were the subject of copyright infringement complaints. And the court said, no, this isn't infringing, right? Now they gave a kind of fancy doctrinal reason for why it wasn't infringing. But the real reason, guys, the real reason the court said that that stuff wasn't infringing is because consumers love it and use it and it's a really valuable product, right? I mean, if Google Image Search is copyright infringing, that means no more Google. People love Google. It's a great product that people use for really productive things in ways that don't harm copyright owners at all, right? There's no way the court was going to say Google Image Search was infringing and Google has to shut it down, right? There's no way the court was going to say Google Books is infringing and Google has to shut it down. There's no way the courts were going to say VCRs are per se infringing. You're not allowed to sell them anymore. They're great for consumers and consumers. By contrast, right, you look at a Napster or a Grokster, right, where the entire purpose of the software was to enable people to engage in copyright infringement more effectively. Right?
I was a big LimeWire guy.
Right, LimeWire actually used to be a client, actually, when I worked at Sullivan & Cromwell. But the courts looked at that and said, this isn't really a new technology that people are using for something productive. This is just technology intended for the purpose of copyright infringement. And so in those cases, the courts didn't feel bad about saying that's infringing because they didn't feel like that they were depriving consumers of a technology that was actually valuable to consumers on its own terms. They felt that they were only depriving consumers of access to a technology that would facilitate infringing activity, right? So I'm pretty optimistic about these AI cases, because whatever the copyright owners say to complain about them, we all know that the reason people like and use AI is not in order to infringe, right? That's not the, if that's all that AI did, it wouldn't be interesting.
Yeah,
100%. And let's take this to kind of a broader view of intellectual property rights and artificial intelligence and where all of this is going to need to move. You dubbed it a paradigm shift that kind of needs to happen in, on this front. And you had a lot of really great thoughts about this when we were talking NFTs. Mm-hmm. So when you envision that paradigm shift and what the future looks like as we, you know, adopt this new technology into our everyday lives and into our society, what does that look like to you?
Yeah. I mean, so I'm increasingly of the mind that the future of the independent of the entertainment industry writ large, and in that I include any kind of content that people are producing for the purpose of consumer consumption, I'm increasingly of the mind that the future of that industry is based around brands, not around texts or not around works, right? Historically, we've thought about the entertainment industry as fundamentally being about ownership and control of particular works of authorship in whatever genre, right? And we've been in the business of selling copies, right? That's why copyright was, and we call it copyright because it was the right to make copies of things. And it was invented really kind of privately and then ultimately enacted by governments as a policy tool for encouraging investment in the production of works of authorship that consumers wanted, right? In effect, the fundamental purpose of copyright was always to benefit publishers of various kinds by enabling them to invest with confidence in a product, or at least more confidence, right? Because they knew that they didn't have to contend with competitors, in effect, taking advantage of their investment to see what was going to be popular and then scooping it from them. Right. So in effect, the purpose of copyright was to make it possible initially for book publishers to, you know, publish a whole bunch of books so that the per unit cost would be lower and know that somebody else wouldn't be able to just kind of see which book was popular and then make copies only of that one. Right. That was the original purpose. And that's kind of why we've had copyright protection ever since. Right. Because there are costs associated with the production and distribution of copies of works of authorship, and the people producing those copies needed to be able to kind of invest in with confidence in what they were producing. Digital technology made that increasingly, or rather fundamentally, not the case anymore, because now production and distribution costs are effectively zero. I think one of the things that AI has done is actually further reduce the costs, right, by eliminating a lot of the costs associated with the creation of the works in the first place, right? The primary remaining cost for a lot of works of authorship is the human cost involved in actually generating the works in the first place. And what AI shows us is at least possible is that a lot of works, maybe not all works, but a lot of works and a lot of kinds of works can be generated automatically rather than requiring people to produce them. So I think that what's likely to happen long term is that we move away from a model in which we use copyright to make artificially scarce works of authorship in order to enable investment in them, because we don't need that anymore, and refocus on what's actually scarce, which is the commercial goodwill, or I like to call it the clout associated with a particular author, right? Because at the end of the day, when people consume works of authorship, what they're really consuming in a lot of ways is their desire to feel a connection with the person who produced, or the company, whatever, that produced the work of authorship that they're consuming. They have lots of options of what to consume, but they tend to pick familiar brands. They pick the brands that they like, and they want to consume the brands that they like. And I think that tells us a lot about where the real value is. I think the value is in the brand, not in the product. And in some ways, one of the things that AI starts to show us, I think, is that in a lot of respects, often the product itself doesn't really matter that much, right? Like when people listen to pop music, it's like, well, I like this song, I like that song, but I really like Taylor Swift. Right. And whatever Taylor Swift produces, I'm going to listen to it. Right. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, the song is good or bad. I'm going to like it because it's Taylor Swift and I like Taylor Swift. And it doesn't matter what song she's singing. The same way that people feel about Elvis. Right. Elvis could sing the dumbest song imaginable and Elvis fans are still going to eat it up. But it doesn't make any difference. Right. And it's because the value is the brand, not the product.
So I guess one way to articulate this and give it a tangible example with something that actually happened was, you know, Drake and The Weeknd, brands in themselves, they have a voice that people recognize. There was a song made by AI that was actually great and it actually went viral. People loved it. You're saying in the future that the work that they've already created isn't as important as the brand and the voice that they've created overall. And now in the world of AI, we've got to consider how to take their brand and their voice being used to create a brand new work. Mm-hmm. That's what you're saying at a high level, that is the problem that needs to be figured out. Yeah. And that somebody used their sound of their voice to recreate something that they didn't. And you're saying in the future that we're going to have to figure out how to monetize that and get some bit of that revenue to the creators whose voice that belongs to. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Kind of, yes, but maybe or maybe not. Right? Because I think, if we think about that as an example, right, one of the reasons that AI-generated track was so popular was that people have really strong positive associations with Drake and The Weeknd. And so when they saw them mashed together, they liked the confluence of those things and thought it was cool and fun and wanted to talk about it. However, did that hurt or harm the brand of Drake or The Weeknd? Right? We're still both talking about them. And in some respects, these may actually be complementary uses, right? It may actually have slightly, ever so slightly, increased the value of the brand of Drake and The Weeknd to be the first two artists to be the subject of a really successful mashup. And again, these kind of mashups are nothing fundamentally new. Right? I mean, you know, Danger Mouse put out the Grey album a long time ago, not as famous as, you know, didn't get it probably as many clicks as the Drake Weeknd mashup, right? But that was, you know, combining the Beatles and Jay-Z, right? Did the Grey album, did Danger Mouse harm the brand of the Beatles or Jay-Z? No, if anything, it made it cooler, right? People liked it more, right? So I think there's actually a lot of synergies and complementarities here. I think the problem will come in when people want to try to use brands in ways that detract from the brand value or that siphon off some of the goodwill associated with the artist, right? So the difference for me would be, you know, if they'd released an AI track and said, this is the new Drake track, right? You should buy this because it's Drake, and misled consumers as to what it was they were consuming in order to effectively steal some of the profits associated with goodwill, with the goodwill that would otherwise have gone to Drake. I think that would be the kind of competition we'd be concerned about, but there can also be productive competition, right? And if we think about this in terms of brands, instead of in terms of copyright and controlling the use of works, I think that actually opens up the possibility for that kind of complementarity in a really nice, interesting, and productive way, right? The more we let people use things, the more new things they produce and the more innovation we see.
Yeah. So there might be a future where, you know, on demand, you can make a Drake song and make it sound the way that you want. And that future, Drake might make less money on his works of music, but his brand and the other ways that he monetizes his brand go up. That's what you're saying.
Exactly. Exactly. And think about it. Like, this is what celebrities already do.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, how do celebrities make money? They make it by lending their name to all manner of different products, by endorsing things, by allowing their name and likeness to be used in different contexts, right? The more markets there are available for them to participate in, the more ability there is for them to leverage their brand value.
Yeah, and it's also just interesting to just continue to take this out into the future. You've seen these marketing agencies create digital influencers that have no real, they're just purely digital influencers. And so in that world, what happens when the voice is not even belonging to a real human for them to monetize? It's all digital. So like, take it out far enough and Drake might be in a bad spot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, I mean, that's competition for you, for better or for worse. I mean, at the end of the day, at least in theory, the purpose of policy in these areas is to benefit consumers, right? We want to set up markets that benefit consumers by maximizing the volume and minimizing the price of the products that consumers want to purchase and consume. If it turns out that consumers really like artificial influencers, or consumers really like AI-generated texts or AI-generated images or AI-generated movies, right, then oh well. too bad for anyone who wants, like, I guess my response to that is, if you can't compete with a bullshit generator, that's kind of on you, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe to flip it around, if what consumers really want is bullshit, maybe we should look at that as kind of liberating, right? I mean, so what I like to say about a lot of these AI programs in response to kind of artists who complain about them is that we should be delighted as artists about AI software, because they free us from the burden of producing bullshit and allow us to actually produce creative works if we want to. Hmm. And I think in a lot of respects, the real problem is that a lot of people really like producing bullshit because they like consuming bullshit.
I think that's a clip line right there. You know, one of the things that that we talked about in one of the last podcasts that we did about AI, when Evan and I were covering OpenAI's Sora model, the new video text to video generation model, is I don't think we're that far off from, if you have very valuable intellectual property like Disney or like NBC or Universal or whoever, I see this future where you can now take this existing intellectual property, the brand as you're talking about it, and create a ton more value out of that brand, because you can now just generate a new episode of Star Wars or generate a new episode of The Office or whatever the case may be. So that's where I really see a lot of value coming. I think what I don't understand yet, and maybe you have some thoughts on this, is what's the mechanism that could make this possible? I think that's where I'm still a little bit confused. And I don't know if anybody actually knows that.
Logan, if I knew that, I wouldn't be telling
you. You'd be rich. Yes. You'd be rich, Palmer. For sure. Oh,
man. If only.
Yeah, if only. Right?
If only. If only I knew the answer to those kinds of questions, I would not be in the business line that I'm in. I'd be doing something a lot more lucrative.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if something like blockchain, like crypto, like NFTs, could be the solution to that in some way, shape, or form. I mean, I'm just speculating at this point. I'm honestly not sure.
Yeah, either. I mean, I think the thing that I've really found is that it's amazingly hard to make predictions, especially about the future. to quote Yogi Berra, right? I mean, it's easy to see things in retrospect, and that's kind of what the job of a law professor is. In a lot of ways, is to look at what's happened, at least in my opinion, to look at what's happened and try to describe it in a way that's useful and helpful to people who want to understand the world and how it works a little bit better. I think there's a tendency from a lot of people to try to predict what's going to happen in the future. And I've always thought of that as being kind of a fool's errand, right? I mean, like, I have visions of what's possible, but God only knows what's actually going to take place. And if I've learned anything, it's that I'm usually wrong.
I got a question for you that's kind of outside the scope of this, just kind of a fun question. With your background in film and spending time on that side of the house, mm-hmm. when you saw OpenAI's Sora model, what did you think about the industry and the accomplishment, frankly, that OpenAI has happened to bring about here? So what's your thoughts when you saw that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, so I think a lot of this stuff is, it's really cool and exciting that it works in the way that it does. And I'm really interested in primarily in what these models tell us about ourselves and about how we actually engage in and think about the production of texts of various kinds. Right. So I can't say I find the actual content that it produces very interesting, but that doesn't make me think that other people won't find it very interesting. It just doesn't happen to be the kind of thing that I care a lot about. But what's interesting about all of these systems is because of how they're designed, right? They are made to produce the kinds of things that people are familiar with and like. Right? They're designed to produce familiar, banal, generic content, right? And I think that that's really, it's intrinsically kind of cool and exciting and tells us a lot about how we go about thinking about expressing ourselves. So there's one thing an observation I think is actually really worth kind of reflecting on. You know, roughly 60, 70 years ago now, Roland Barthes, a French theorist, predicted what he referred to as the death of the author, right? And what he meant by that was that there was a recognition that the meaning of a text is generated not only by the author of the text, by the person who produced it, but also by the reader who experiences it. Right? That you give the text its ultimate meaning when you consume it. And that text, that meaning that you add to it isn't latent in the text itself. It comes from you. What's really cool to me about AI is that it's like the obituary of the author, right? In the sense that the content produced by an AI model has no meaning until it's consumed. None whatsoever. Right? Because an AI doesn't mean anything. Like when an LLM produces a string of words, it's not doing so in order to convey ideas. It, at least in theory, is just predicting what word is most likely to come next. It isn't until a person reads the text and derives meaning from it that it becomes meaningful at all. Right? And I think that that tells us something really interesting about meaning making and how we project meaning onto the things that we consume.
Logan, we just had this conversation the other day, we extrapolated out when most content on the internet, let's just use social media, for example, when most content on Instagram is created by AI, the value of content goes to zero. The volume of content goes up. You know, I watch dog videos on Instagram because they make me laugh because I know they're real dogs and I love dogs. But when Instagram is flooded with AI-generated videos of dogs, do I care about those as much as I cared about the real ones? Do they have as much meaning to me? And I don't think the answer is yes. Yeah. What does that mean for us consuming content and what means something versus what doesn't mean anything. I don't know the answer to that, but I don't see a really good future from a mental health perspective when we can't tell what has meaning and what's not and what doesn't anymore, because we don't know if it's generated by AI or if it's a real video of a dog.
Yeah.
I don't know what that world looks like. I'm sure you don't either, but that's a very scary thing to think about, riffing off of what you said, that content has meaning given to it by the person consuming it. Mm-hmm. And if it's generated by AI and I know that, or I don't know that, that really kind of hurts the meaning of almost everything I see online in a lot of ways, because I can't distinguish between the two.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I'm probably wrong, but I see kind of two primary ways in which that could potentially play out, right? So one way it could play out is that ultimately we realize that we don't care, right? And that we're perfectly happy with AI generated content and we just want something to consume. And it doesn't really matter how it was created. What matters is the enjoyment we take from consuming it. The other possibility I foresee, and there probably are ones I'm not thinking of, but the other one I think that is most salient to me is that we realize that what we actually want is novelty and difference, right? That we actually want the thing we call creativity, but don't actually show revealed preferences for consuming, and develop a preference for a kind of creativity in the kind of novelty, difference, unexpectedness sort of sense that late 20th, early 20th century content has not tended to exhibit in substantial degree. So it's possible, I think, that AI could actually be a renaissance for human-generated content, mm-hmm. insofar as, once again, as I say, right, it frees us from the burden of producing all the bullshit and allows creative people to just be creative instead of producing bullshit.
I totally agree with that point of it. I think there is room for both ultimately. And I think it is a helpful framing when you frame it as like, you don't have to create the bullshit. You can be truly creative in the way that you want to be truly creative. And you can let the generative AI create the other stuff that kind of fills that void. But as we wrap it up here, I mean, this has been, I think, one of the more informative episodes about AI, just because it's really where the rubber meets the road in a lot of ways. When you think about how is this technology going to be regulated, I think copyright law is a lot of, at least in these early days, ways that's being applied. But as we're ending things here, you know, normally we try to do a plug for our guest companies or anything. This one's obviously a little bit different. So go ahead and plug your X account, your Twitter account. You're a great follow on there. So talk about that. And then I think you're still doing the Ipsy Dixit podcast as well. So plug that as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm on Twitter at Brian L. Fry, BrianLFrye. I also have a podcast primarily on legal scholarship called Ipsa Dixit, IPSEDIXIT. And it's on all the big podcast platforms. And if you're interested in legal scholarship, you can check out my SSRN page. Everything is free and plagiarism encouraged.
I love that. Awesome. All right, well, Brian, thanks again for coming on and sharing your perspective with us. It's been a really fun conversation.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you guys. Talk to you soon.